strip of ice on Lake Mälaren. He could not imagine why anyone would want to spend their free time in such an isolated place. He felt suddenly uncomfortable when he shut the car door behind him. The forest seemed threatening, as if it were closing in around him. He sensed that he was being watched. He started towards the cabin, but he heard a rustling that made him stop short. He stared into the woods. It was dusk, silent with no wind. He stood there for 2 minutes, with his nerves on full alert, before, seeing it out of the corner of his eye, he realized that a figure was silently, slowly moving in the trees. When his eyes focused, he saw that the figure was standing perfectly still, about 30 yards into the forest, staring at him. He felt a vague panic. He tried to make out details. He saw a dark, bony face. It appeared to be a dwarf, no more than half his own size, and dressed in something that looked like a tunic of pine branches and moss. A forest troll? A leprechaun? He held his breath. He felt the hairs rise on the back of his neck. Then he blinked 6 times and shook his head. When he looked again, the creature had moved about 10 yards to the right. There was nobody there. He knew that he was imagining things, and yet he could so clearly make out the figure in the trees. Suddenly it moved, and came closer. It seemed to be lurching in a semicircle to get into a position to attack him. The blond giant hurried to the cabin. He knocked a little too hard on the door. As soon as he heard voices within, his panic subsided. He looked over his shoulder. There was nothing there. But he did not breathe out until the door opened. Bjørman greeted him courteously and invited him in. Miriam Wu was panting when she arrived back upstairs after dragging the last trash bag of Salander's possessions down to the recycling room in the cellar. The apartment was clinically clean and smelled of soap, paint, and freshly brewed coffee made by Salander. She was sitting on a stool, gazing thoughtfully at the bare rooms from which curtains, rugs, discount coupons on the refrigerator, and her usual junk in the hall had vanished as if by magic. She was amazed at how much bigger the apartment seemed. Mimi and Salander did not have the same taste in clothes, furniture, or intellectual stimulation. Correction. Mimi had taste and definite views on how she wanted her living quarters to look, what kind of furniture she wanted, and what sort of clothes one should wear. Salander had no taste whatsoever, Mimi realized. After she had inspected the apartment on Lundegarten as closely as an estate agent might, they had discussed things, and Mimi had decided that most of the stuff had to go, especially the disgusting dirt-brown sofa in the living room. Did Salander want to keep any of the things? No. Then Mimi had spent a few long days, as well as several hours each evening for 2 weeks, throwing out bits of old furniture, cleaning cupboards, scrubbing the floor, scouring the bathtub, and repainting the walls in the kitchen, living room, bedroom, and hall. She also varnished the parquet floor in the living room. Salander had no interest in such tasks, but she came several times to watch Mimi at work, fascinated. Eventually the apartment was empty of everything, except for a kitchen table of solid wood, much the worse for wear, that Mimi intended to sand down and refinish, 2 stools that Salander had pounced on when an attic in the building was cleared, and a set of sturdy shelves in the living room that Mimi thought she could repaint.
"I'm moving in this weekend, unless you're going to change your mind. I don't need the apartment. But it's a great apartment. I mean, there are bigger and better apartments, but it's slap in the middle of Surda, and the rent is nothing. Lisbeth, you're passing up a fortune by not selling it. I have enough to get by."
Mimi shut up, not sure how to interpret Salander's brusque dismissal.
"Where are you living now?"
Salander did not reply.
"Could a person come and visit you?" "Not right now."
Salander opened her shoulder bag, took out some papers, and passed them over to Mimi.
"I've fixed the agreement with the housing association. The simplest thing is to register you as my roommate, and say I'm selling half of the apartment to you. The price is 1 krona. You have to sign the contract."
Mimi took the pen and signed the contract, adding her date of birth.
"Is that all?"
"That's it."
"Lisbeth, I've always thought you were a little weird. Do you realize that you just gave away half of this apartment to me? I'd love to have the apartment, but I don't want to end up in a situation where you suddenly regret it, or it causes bad feelings between us. There never will be any bad feelings. I want you to live here. It feels right to me.
But with nothing in return?
You're nuts.
You're taking care of my mail. That's the deal.
That'll take me an average of 4 seconds a week. Do you intend to come over once in a while to have sex?
Salander fixed her eyes on Mimi. She was quiet for a moment.
I'd like to very much. But it's not part of the contract. You can say no whenever you want.
Mimi sighed.
And here I was, just beginning to enjoy being a kept woman. You know, having somebody who gives me an apartment and pays my rent and comes over now and then to wrestle around in bed.
They sat in silence for a while. Then Mimi stood up resolutely and went into the living room to turn off the bare bulb in the ceiling fixture.
Come here.
Salander followed her.
I've never had sex on the floor of a newly painted apartment with almost no furniture. I saw a movie with Marlon Brando once about a couple in Paris who did it.
Salander glanced at the floor.
I feel like playing. Are you up for it?
Mimi said.
I'm almost always up for it. Tonight I think I'll be a dominating bitch. I get to make the decisions. Take off your clothes.
Salander smiled a crooked smile. She took off her clothes. It took at least 10 seconds.
Lie down on the floor. On your stomach.
Salander did as Mimi commanded. The parquet floor was cool and her skin got goosebumps immediately. Mimi used Salander's T-shirt with the slogan, "You have the right to remain silent," to tie her hands behind her back. Salander could not help thinking that this was similar to the way Niels fucking slimebag Bjurman had tied her up 2 years ago. The similarities ended there. With Mimi, Salander felt only lustful anticipation. She was compliant when Mimi rolled her over on her back and spread her legs. Salander watched her in the dim room as she pulled off her own T-shirt and was fascinated by her soft breasts. Then Mimi tied her T-shirt as a blindfold over Salander's eyes. She could hear the rustle of clothes. A few seconds later she felt Mimi's tongue on her belly and her fingers on the inside of her thighs. She was more excited than she had been in a long time. She shut her eyes tight beneath the blindfold and let Mimi set the pace.
Chapter 8. Monday, February 14th to Saturday, February 19th.
Armansky looked up when he heard the light knock on the door jamb and saw Salander in the doorway. She was balancing 2 cups from the espresso machine. He put down his pen and pushed the report away.
"Hi,"
she said.
"Hi."
"This is a social call," she said. "May I come in?"
Armansky closed his eyes for a second. Then he pointed at the visitor's chair. He glanced at the clock. It was 6:30 in the evening. Salander gave him one of the cups and sat down. They took stock of each other for a moment.
"More than a year," Armansky said.
Salander nodded.
"Are you mad?"
"Should I be?"
"I didn't say goodbye."
Armansky pursed his lips. He was shocked to see her, but at the same time relieved to discover that at least she wasn't dead. He suddenly felt a strong sense of irritation and weariness.
"I don't know what to say," he said. "You don't have any obligation to tell me what you're working on. What do you want?"
His voice sounded cooler than he had intended.
"I'm not sure. I mostly just wanted to say hello."
"Do you need a job? I'm not going to employ you again."
She shook her head.
"Are you working somewhere else?"
She shook her head again. She seemed to be trying to formulate her words. Armansky waited.
"I've been traveling," she said at last. "I'm only recently back."
Armansky studied her. There was a new kind of maturity in her choice of clothes and her bearing. And she had stuffed her bra with something.
"You've changed. Where have you been?"
"Here and there,"
she said. But when she saw his annoyance, she added,
"I went to Italy and kept going, to the Middle East, to Hong Kong via Bangkok. I was in Australia for a while and New Zealand, and I island-hopped my way across the Pacific. I was in Tahiti for a month, then I travelled through the US, and I spent the last few months in the Caribbean. I don't know why I didn't say goodbye."
"I'll tell you why. Because you don't give a shit about other people."
Armansky said matter-of-factly. Salander bit her lower lip.
Usually it's other people who don't give a shit about me.
Bullshit, Armansky said. You've got an attitude problem, and you treat people like dirt when they're trying to be your friends. It's that simple.
Silence.
Do you want me to leave?
You do as you like. You always have. But if you leave now, I never want to see you again.
Salander was suddenly afraid. Someone she respected was about to reject her. She did not know what to say.
It's been 2 years since Holger Palmgren had his stroke. You haven't once visited him,
Armansky went on relentlessly. Salander stared at Armansky, shocked.
Palmgren is alive.
You don't even know if he's alive or dead.
The doctors said that he...
The doctors said a lot about him, Armansky interrupted. He was in a very bad way, and couldn't communicate with anyone, but in the last year he's recovered quite a bit. He doesn't articulate too well. You have to listen carefully to understand what he's saying. He needs help with a lot of things, but he can go to the toilet by himself. People who care about him call in to spend time with him.
Salander sat dumbfounded. She was the one who had found Palmgren after he had his stroke 2 years earlier. She had called the ambulance, and the doctors had shaken their heads and said that the prognosis was not encouraging. She had lived at the hospital for 3 days until a doctor told her that Palmgren was in a coma, and it was extremely unlikely that he would come out of it. She had stood up and left the hospital without looking back, and obviously without checking to find out what had happened. She frowned. She had had Niels Bjurman foisted on her at the same time, and he had absorbed a lot of her attention. But nobody, not even Armansky, had told her that Palmgren was still alive, or that he was getting better. She had never considered that possibility. Her eyes filled with tears. Never in her life had she felt like such a selfish shit, and never had she been savaged in such a furious manner. She bowed her head. They sat in silence until Armansky said,
"How are you doing?"
Salander shrugged.
"How are you making a living? Do you have work?"
"No, I don't. And I don't know what kind of work I want, but I've got a certain amount of money, so I'm getting by."
Armansky scrutinized her with searching eyes.
"I just came by to say hello. I'm not looking for a job. I don't know... Maybe I'd do a job for you if you need me sometime, but it would have to be something that interests me."
"I don't suppose you want to tell me what happened up in Hedestad last year?"
Salander did not answer.
"Well, something happened. Martin Wanger drove his car into a truck after you'd been back here to borrow surveillance gear. And somebody threatened you. And his sister came back from the dead. It was a sensation, to put it mildly."
"I've given my word I wouldn't talk about it."
"And you don't want to tell me what role you played in the Wennerström affair, either?"
"I helped Kalle Blomqvist with research."
Her voice was suddenly much cooler.
"That was all. I didn't want to get involved."
"Blomqvist has been looking for you high and low. He's called here once a month to ask if I've heard anything from you."
Salander remained silent, but Armansky saw that her lips were now pressed into a tight line.
"I can't say that I like him," Armansky said. "But he cares about you, too. I met him once last autumn. He didn't want to talk about Hedestad, either."
Salander did not want to discuss Blomqvist.
"I just came to say hello and tell you that I'm back. I don't know if I'll be staying. This is my mobile number and my new email address if you need to get hold of me."
She handed Armansky a piece of paper and stood up. She was already at the door when he called after her.
"Wait a second. What are you going to do?"
"I'm going to say hello to Holger Palmgren."
"Okay, but I mean, what kind of work will you be doing?"
"I don't know."
"But you have to make a living."
"I told you, I have enough to get by."
Armansky leaned back in his chair. He was never quite sure how to interpret her words.
"I've been so fucking angry that you vanished without a word, that I almost decided never to trust you again."
He made a face.
"You're so unreliable. But you're a damned good researcher. I might have a job coming up that would be a good fit for you."
She shook her head, but she came back to his desk.
I don't want a job from you. I mean, I don't need one. I'm serious. I'm financially independent.
Armansky frowned.
Okay. You're financially independent, whatever that means. I'll take your word for it. But when you need a job...
Dragan, you're the second person I've visited since I got home. I don't need your work. But for several years now, you've been one of the few people that I respect.
Everybody has to make a living.
Sorry, but I'm no longer interested in doing personal investigations. Let me know if you run into a really interesting problem.
What sort of problem?
The kind you can't make heads or tails of. If you get stuck and don't know what to do. If I'm going to do a job for you, you'll have to come up with something special. Maybe on the operations side.
Operations side? You? But you disappear without a trace whenever you feel like it.
I've never skipped out on a job that I agreed to do.
Armansky looked at her helplessly. The term operations was jargon, but it meant field work. It could be anything from bodyguard duty to surveillance assignments for art exhibitions. His operations personnel were confident, stable veterans, many of them with a police background, and 90% of them were men. Salander was the polar opposite of all the criteria he had set out for personnel in the operations unit of Milton Security.
Well,
he said dubiously, but she had vanished out the door. Armansky shook his head.
She's weird. She's really weird.
The next second, Salander was back in the doorway.
Oh, by the way, you've got two guys spending a month protecting that actress Christine Rutherford from the nutcase who writes her threatening letters. You think it's an inside job because the letter writer knows so many details about her.
Armansky stared at Salander. An electric shock went through him.
She's done it again. She's flung out a line about a case she absolutely cannot know a thing about.
So?
It's a fake. She and her boyfriend have been writing the letters as a publicity stunt. She's going to get another letter in the next few days, and they'll leak it to the media next week. They'll probably accuse Milton of leaking it. Cross her off your client list now.
Before Armansky could say anything, she was gone. He stared at the empty doorway. She could not possibly have known a single detail of the case. She must have an insider at Milton who kept her updated. But only four or five people apart from himself knew about it, the operations chief and the few people who reported on the threats. And they were all stable pros. Armansky rubbed his chin. He looked down at his desk. The Rutherford file was locked inside it. The office had a burglar alarm. He glanced at the clock again and realized that Harry Franson, chief of the technical department, would have finished for the day. He started up his email and sent a message asking Franson to come to his office the following morning to install a surveillance camera. Salander walked straight home to Musabaka. She hurried because she had a feeling it was urgent. She called the hospital in Surda, and after some stalling from the switchboard managed to find out Palmgren's whereabouts. For the past 14 months, he had been in a rehabilitation home in Ersta. All of a sudden, she had a vision of Apelviken. When she called, she was told that he was asleep, but that she was welcome to visit him the next day. Salander spent the evening pacing back and forth in her apartment. She was in a foul mood. She went to bed early and fell asleep almost at once. She woke at 7 a.m, showered and had breakfast at the 7-Eleven. At 8, she walked to the car rental agency on Ringvägen.
I've got to get my own car.
She rented the same Nissan Micra she had driven to Apelviken a few weeks earlier. She was unaccountably nervous when she parked near the rehabilitation center, but she gathered up her courage and went inside. The woman at the front desk consulted her papers and explained that Holger Palmgren was in the gym for therapy just then and would not be available until after 11. Salander was welcome to take a seat in the waiting room or come back later. She went and sat in the car and smoked 3 cigarettes while she waited. At 11 she went back to the front desk. She was told to go to the dining hall, down the corridor to the right and then to the left. She stopped in the doorway and recognized Palmgren in the half-empty dining room. He sat facing her, but was focusing all his attention on his plate. He held his fork in an awkward grip and steered the food to his mouth with great concentration. Every third time or so he missed, and the food fell off the fork. He looked shrunken. He might be 100 years old. His face seemed strangely immobile. He was sitting in a wheelchair. Only then did Salander take it in that he was alive, that Armansky had not just been punishing her. Pahlgrim swore silently as he tried for the third time to spear a bite of macaroni and cheese onto his fork. He was resigned to being unable to walk properly, and he accepted that there was a great deal he would be unable to do, but he hated not being able to eat properly and the fact that sometimes he drooled like a baby. He knew exactly what it was he should do. Lower the fork at the right angle, push it forward, lift it, and guide it to his mouth. The problem was with the coordination. His hand had a life of its own. When he instructed it to lift, it would slide slowly to the side of the plate. If he did manage to steer it towards his mouth, it would often change direction at the last moment and land on his cheek or his chin. But the rehabilitation was producing results. 6 months earlier, his hand would shake so much that he could not get a single spoonful into his mouth. His meals might still be taking a long time, but at least he was eating by himself, and he was going to go on working at it until he once again had full control over his limbs. As he lowered his fork to collect another mouthful, a hand appeared from behind him and gently took it from him. He watched as the fork shoveled up some of the macaroni and cheese and raised it. He thought he knew the thin, doll-like hand, and turned his head to meet Salander's eyes. Her gaze was expectant. She seemed anxious. For a long moment Palmgren stared at her face. His heart was suddenly pounding in a most unreasonable way. Then he opened his mouth and accepted the food. She fed him one bite at a time. Normally Palmgren hated being spoon-fed, but he understood Salander's need. It was not because he was a helpless piece of baggage. She was feeding him as a gesture of humility, in her case an extraordinarily rare occurrence. She put the right-sized portions on the fork and waited until he was finished chewing. When he pointed at the glass of milk with a straw, she held it up so he could drink. When he had swallowed the last mouthful, she put the fork down and gave him a questioning look. He shook his head. They had not said a word to each other during the entire meal. Palmgren leaned back in his wheelchair and took a deep breath. Salander picked up the napkin and wiped around his mouth. He felt like a mafia boss in an American movie where a capo di tutti capi was showing respect. He imagined how she would kiss his hand and smiled at the absurdity of this fantasy.
"Do you think it will be possible to get a cup of coffee in this place?" he said.
He slurred his words. His lips and tongue could not shape the sounds.
"Serve tub, run corn."
"The serving table is around the corner," she worked it out.
"You want a cup? Milk, no sugar, as always?"
He signalled yes with his hand. She carried his tray away and came back a minute later with two cups of coffee. He noticed that she drank hers black, which was unusual. He smiled when he saw that she had saved the straw from his milk for the coffee cup. Palmgren had a thousand things to say, but he could not formulate a single syllable. But their eyes kept meeting time after time. Salander looked terribly guilty. Finally she broke the silence.
"I thought you'd died," she said. "If I'd known you were alive, I would have come to see you a long time ago. Forgive me."
He bowed his head. He smiled, a twist of the lips.
"You were in a coma when I left you, and the doctors told me you were going to die. They said you would be dead within a few days, and I just walked away. I'm so sorry."
He lifted his hand and laid it on her little fist. She took his hand in a firm grip.
"You despaired."
"You disappeared."
"Dragan Armansky told you?"
He nodded.
"I was off travelling. I needed to get away. I didn't say goodbye to anybody, just left. Were you worried?"
He shook his head from side to side, slowly.
"You don't ever have to worry about me."
"I never worried about you. You always get back. But I'm just worried."
"I never worried about you," You always get by. But Armansky was worried. She smiled her usual crooked smile at him, and Palmgren relaxed. He studied her, comparing his memory of her with the woman he saw before him. She had changed. She was whole and clean, and rather well-dressed. She had taken out the ring that was in her lip, and, the wasp tattoo on her neck was gone, too. She looked grown up. He laughed for the first time in many weeks. It sounded like a coughing fit. Salander's smile grew bigger, and she suddenly felt a warmth that she had not felt in a long time filling her heart.
Good.
You did good. He aimed a hand at her clothes. She nodded.
I'm doing fine.
How's new garden?
How is the new guardian? Palmgren noticed Salander's face darken. Her mouth tightened. She looked at him frankly.
He's okay. I can handle him.
Palmgren's eyebrows questioned her. Salander looked around the dining room and changed the subject.
How long have you been here?
Palmgren may have had a stroke, and he still had difficulty speaking and coordinating his movements, but his mind was intact, and his radar instantly picked up a false tone in Salander's voice. In all the years he had known her, he had come to realize that she never lied to him directly. But neither was she totally candid. Her way of not telling him the truth was to distract his attention. There was obviously some problem with her new guardian, which did not surprise Palmgren. He felt a deep sense of remorse. How many times had he thought about calling his colleague Niels Bjurman, a fellow lawyer, after all, if not a friend, to ask how Salander was doing, but then neglected to do so? And why had he not contested her declaration of incompetence while he still had the power? He knew why. He had wanted, selfishly, to keep his contact with her alive. He loved this damned, difficult child like the daughter he never had, and he wanted to have an excuse to maintain the relationship. Besides, it was physically too difficult. He had enough trouble just opening his fly when he tottered to the toilet. He felt as if he were the one who had let Lisbeth Salander down.
But she'll always survive. She's the most competent person I've ever met. District.
I didn't understand.
District Court.
The District Court? What do you mean?
Could I cancel your crash?
Palmgren's face turned red, and he grimaced when he could not pronounce the words. Salander put a hand on his arm and pressed gently.
Olga, don't worry about me. I have plans to take on my declaration of incompetence soon. It's not your worry any longer, but I may need your help eventually. Is that okay? Will you be my lawyer if I need you?
He shook his head.
Too old.
He rapped his knuckle on the arm of his wheelchair.
Dumb old man.
Yeah, you're a dumb old man if you have that attitude. I need a legal advisor, and I want you. You may not be able to give a statement in court, but you can give me advice when the time comes, would you?
He shook his head again, and then he nodded.
Work?
I don't understand.
What do you work on? Not arms.
What are you working on? Not Armansky. Salander hesitated while she debated how to explain her situation. It was complicated.
I'm not working for Armansky anymore. I don't need to work for him to make a living. I have my own money, and I'm doing fine.
Palmgren's eyebrows knitted together again.
I'll come and visit you a lot, starting today. I'll tell you all about... But let's not get stressed about things. Right now there's something else I want to do.
She bent down and lifted a bag to the table and took out a chessboard.
I haven't had the chance to sweep the floor with you for 2 whole years.
He gave up. She was up to some mischief that she did not want to talk about. He was quite sure he would have severe reservations. But he trusted her enough still to know that whatever she was up to might be dubious in the eyes of the law, but not a crime against God's laws. Unlike most other people who knew her, Palmgren was sure that Salander was a genuinely moral person. The problem was that her notion of morality did not always coincide with that of the justice system. She set out the chessmen in front of him, and he recognized with shock that it was his own board. She must have pinched it from the apartment after he fell ill, as a keepsake. She gave him white. All of a sudden, he was as happy as a child. Salander stayed with Palmgren for 2 hours. She had crushed him 3 times before a nurse interrupted their bickering over the board, announcing that it was time for his afternoon physical therapy. Salander collected the chessmen and folded up the board.
"Can you tell me what kind of physical therapy he's getting?" she said. "It's strength and coordination training, and we're making progress, aren't we?"
Palmgren nodded grimly.
"You can already walk several steps. By summer you'll be able to walk by yourself in the park. Is this your daughter?"
Salander's and Palmgren's eyes met.
"Daughter?"
"Foster, daughter."
"How nice that you came to visit."
"Where the hell have you been all this time?" Salander ignored the unmistakable meaning. She leaned forward and kissed Palmgren on the cheek.
"I'll come again on Friday."
Palmgren stood up laboriously from his wheelchair. She walked with him to an elevator. As soon as the elevator doors had closed, she went to the front desk and asked to speak to whoever was responsible for the patients. She was referred to a Dr. A. Sivanandan, whom she found in an office further down a corridor. She introduced herself, explaining that she was Palmgren's foster daughter.
"I'd like to know how he's doing and what's going to happen with him."
Dr. Sivanandan looked up Palmgren's casebook and read the introductory pages. His skin was pitted by smallpox, and he had a thin moustache which Salander found absurd. Finally he sat back. To her surprise he spoke with a Finnish accent.
"I have no record of Herr Palmgren having a daughter or foster daughter. In fact, his nearest relative would seem to be an 86-year-old cousin in Jämtland."
"He took care of me from when I was 13 until he had his stroke. I was 24 at the time."
She dug into the inside pocket of her jacket and threw a pen onto the desk in front of the doctor.
"My name is Lisbeth Salander. Write my name in his casebook. I'm the closest relation he has in the world."
"That may be," replied Dr. Sivanandan firmly. "But if you are his closest relation, you certainly took a long time letting us know. As far as I know, he has only had a few visits from a person who, while not related to him, is to be notified in case the state of his health worsens or if he should pass away."
"That will be Dragan Armansky."
Dr. Sivanandan raised his eyebrows.
"That's correct. You know him?
You can call him and verify that I am who I say I am."
"That won't be necessary. I believe you. I was told that you sat and played chess with Herr Palmgren for 2 hours. But I cannot discuss the state of his health with you without his permission."
"And you'll never get it from that stubborn devil. You see, he suffers from the delusion that he shouldn't burden me with his troubles, and that he is still responsible for me and not the other way around. This is how it is. For 2 years I thought he was dead. Yesterday I discovered that he was alive. If I'd known that he... It's complicated to explain, but I'd like to know what sort of prognosis he has and whether he will recover."
Dr. Sivanandan picked up the pen and wrote Salander's name neatly into Palmgren's casebook. He asked for her social security number and telephone number.
"Okay. Now you're formally his foster daughter. This may not be completely by the book, but considering that you're the first person to visit him since last Christmas, when Herr Armansky stopped by, you saw him today. You can see for yourself that he has problems with coordination and speech. He had a stroke."
"Oh, no. I was the one who found him and called the ambulance."
"Aha! Then you should know that he was in intensive care for 3 months. He was in a coma for a long time. Most patients never wake up from a coma like that, but it does happen. Obviously, he wasn't ready to die. First, he was put in the dementia ward for chronic long-term patients who are completely unable to take care of themselves. Against all the odds, he showed signs of improvement and was moved here for rehabilitation 9 months ago."
"Tell me what chances he has of getting his mobility and speech back."
Dr. Sivanandan threw out his hands.
"Have you got a crystal ball that's better than mine? The truthful answer is that I have no idea. He could die from a cerebral hemorrhage tonight, or he could live a relatively normal life for another 20 years. I have no way of knowing. You might say it's God who decides.
And if he lives another 20 years?
It's been a laborious rehabilitation for him, and it's only in the past few months that we have been able to see improvements. 6 months ago he couldn't eat without assistance. 1 month ago he could hardly get out of his chair, which is partly due to muscle atrophy from being in bed for so long. Now at least he can walk by himself for short distances.
Can he get better?
Yes, even a lot better. The first threshold was hard, but now we're seeing progress every day. He has lost almost 2 years of his life. In a few months, by the summer, I hope he'll be able to walk in the park.
And his speech?
His problem is that both his speech center and his ability to move were knocked out. He was helpless for a long time. Since then, he has been forced to learn how to control his body and talk again. He doesn't always remember which words to use, and he has to learn some words again. But it's not like teaching a child to talk. He knows the meaning of the word, he just can't articulate it. Give him a couple of months, and you'll see how his speech has improved compared with today. The same is true of his ability to get around. 9 months ago he couldn't tell left from right or up from down in the elevator.
Salander thought about this for a moment. She discovered that she liked this Dr. A. Sivarnandan, with his Indian looks and the Finnish accent.
"What does the A stand for?"
she asked. He gave her an amused look.
"Anders."
"Anders?"
"I was born in Sri Lanka, but then adopted by a couple in Obu when I was 3 months old."
"Okay, Anders. How can I help?"
"Visit him. Give him intellectual stimulation."
"I can come every day."
"I don't want you to be here every day. If he likes you, I want him to look forward to your visits, not get bored with them."
"Could any type of special care improve his odds? I can pay whatever it costs."
He smiled at Salander.
"I'm afraid that we're all the special care there is. Of course, I wish we had more resources and that the cutbacks didn't affect us, but I assure you that he's getting very competent care."
"And if you didn't have to worry about the cutbacks, what else could you offer him?"
"The ideal for patients like Holger Palmgren, of course, would be if I could offer him a full-time personal trainer. But it's been quite a while since we had resources like that in Sweden."
"Hire one."
"Excuse me?"
"Hire him a personal trainer. Find the best you can. Please do it first thing tomorrow, and make sure he has everything he needs in the way of technical equipment. I'll see to it that the funds are available by the end of the week to pay for it."
"Are you pulling my leg, young lady?"
Salander gave Dr. Anders Sivanandan her hard, steady look. Johansson braked and pulled her Fiat over to the curb outside Gamla Stan Tunnelbana station. Svensson opened the door and slipped into the passenger seat. He leaned over and gave her a kiss on the cheek as she drew away behind a bus.
"Hello, you,"
she said without taking her eyes off the traffic.
"You look so serious. Has something happened?"
Svensson sighed as he fastened his seatbelt.
"No, nothing major. A little problem with the manuscript is all."
"What problem?"
2 months till the deadline. I've done only 9 of the 22 confrontations we planned. I'm having trouble with Björk at the security police. The bastard is on long-term sick leave and he's not answering his home telephone."
"Is he in hospital?"
"Don't know. Have you ever tried getting information out of Seppo? They won't even admit that he works there."
"Did you try his parents?"
"Both dead. He's not married. He has a brother who lives in Spain. I just have no idea how to get hold of him."
Johansson glanced at her partner as she navigated across Slusen to the tunnel leading to Nynäsvägen.
"Worst-case scenario, we jettison the section on Björk. Blomqvist insists that everyone we're planning to expose must have a chance to comment before being hung out to dry."
"But it would be a shame to miss out on a representative of the security police who runs around with prostitutes. What are you going to do?"
"Find him, of course. How are you doing? Nervous?"
He poked her carefully in the side.
"Actually, no. In 2 months, I have to defend my dissertation and become a full-fledged doctor, and I feel as cool as a cucumber."
"You know the subject backwards.
"Why be nervous? Look behind you." Svensson turned and saw an open box on the back seat.
"Mia, it's printed," he said in delight.
He held up a copy of the bound thesis. "From Russia with Love, Trafficking, Organized Crime and Society's Response, by Mia Johansson."
"It wasn't going to be ready until next week." "Damn, we're going to have to crack open a bottle when we get home. Congratulations, doctor."
He leaned over and kissed her again.
"Calm down. I won't be a doctor for another 3 weeks. And keep your hands under control while I'm driving."
Svensson laughed. Then he turned serious.
"By the way, flying the ointment and all that, you interviewed a girl named Irina P. about a year ago."
"Irina P. 22, from St. Petersburg. She first came here in 1999 and has made some return trips. What about her?"
"I ran into Gulbrandsen today, the policeman involved in the Surdetalia brothel investigation. Did you read last week that they found a girl floating in the canal there? There were headlines in the evening papers. It was Irina P."
"Oh, no. That's horrible." They drove in silence past Shanstall. "She's in my thesis," Johansson said at last. "I gave her the pseudonym Tamara."
Svensson turned to the interview section of From Russia with Love and leafed through it to find Tamara. He read with concentration as Mia passed Gulmasplan and the Globe Arena.
"She was brought here by somebody you call Anton."
"I can't use real names. I might get criticism for it during my oral exams, but I cannot name the girls. It would put them in real mortal danger. And obviously I can't identify the Johns either, since they could work out which of the girls I had talked to. So in all the case studies, I only use pseudonyms."
"Who's Anton?"
"His name is probably Zala. I've never been able to pin down who he is, but I think he's a Pole or a Yugoslav, and that's not his real name. I talked with Irina P. 4 or 5 times, and it wasn't until our last meeting that she told me his name. She was trying to straighten out her life and get out of the business. But she was certainly really afraid of him."
"I'm just wondering. I ran into the name Zala a week or so ago."
"Where was that?"
"I confronted Sandstrom, the John who's a journalist, a complete bastard."
"In what way?"
"He's not a real journalist. He does advertising newsletters for various companies, and he has sick fantasies about rape that he'd get off on with that girl."
"I know. I was the one who interviewed her."
"But did you know that he did the text for a brochure about sexually transmitted diseases for the Public Health Institute?"
"I didn't know that.
I confronted him last week. He totally lost it when I laid out all the evidence and asked why he uses teenage prostitutes from the East to live out his rape fantasies. Gradually I got some sort of explanation out of him."
"And what was it?"
"Sandstrom had gotten into a situation where he wasn't just another customer. He also ran errands for the sex mafia. He gave me the names he knew, including this Zala. He didn't say anything specific about him, but it's not a common name."
Johansson glanced at him.
"Do you know who he is?" Svensson said.
"No. I've never been able to identify him. He's just a name that crops up now and then. The girls all seem terrified of him, and none of them was willing to tell me anything else."
Chapter 9. Sunday, March 6th, to Friday, March 11th. Dr. Sivanandan stopped in his tracks on his way into the dining room when he caught sight of Palmgren and Salander. They were bent over their chessboard. She came once a week now, usually on Sundays. She always arrived at around 3 and spent a couple of hours playing chess with Palmgren. She left around 8 in the evening when it was time for him to go to bed. The doctor had observed that she did not treat him as you would an invalid. On the contrary, it looked like they were squabbling all the time, and she did not mind Palmgren waiting on her, fetching her coffee. Dr. Sivanandan could not make her out. This peculiar young woman who took herself for Palmgren's foster daughter. She had a very striking look about her, and she seemed to treat everything around her with suspicion. She appeared to have no sense of humour at all, or the ability to carry on a normal conversation. And when he asked what kind of work she did, she somehow contrived not to give him an answer. A few days after her first visit, she had come back with a bundle of documents which declared that a non-profit foundation had been established with the sole purpose of assisting the care centre with Palmgren's rehabilitation, The chair of the trustees of the foundation was a lawyer in Gibraltar. There was another lawyer mentioned, also with an address in Gibraltar, and an accountant by the name of Hugo Svensson, with an address in Stockholm. The foundation was to make available funds of up to 2.5 million kronor, which Dr. Sivanandan could dispose of as he wished, but with the exclusive object of giving the patient Holger Palmgren every possible care and facility towards full recovery. Sivanandan had only to request the necessary funds from the accountant. It was an unusual, if not unique, arrangement. Sivanandan had thought hard for several days about whether there was anything unethical about the situation. He decided that there was not, and accordingly hired Johanna Carolina Oskarsson as Holger Palmgren's personal assistant and trainer. She was 39, a certified physical therapist with a degree in psychology and with extensive experience in rehabilitation care. To Sivanandan's surprise, her first month's salary was paid to the hospital in advance, as soon as her employment contract was signed. Until then, he had vaguely worried that this might be some sort of hoax. Within a month, Palmgren's coordination and overall condition had markedly improved. This could be seen from the tests he underwent every week. How much the improvement was due to the training, and how much was thanks to Salander, Sivanandan could only wonder. There was no doubt that Palmgren was making great efforts, and looked forward to her visits with the enthusiasm of a child. It even seemed to amuse him that he was regularly pummeled at the chessboard. Dr. Sivanandan had kept them company on one occasion. Palmgren was playing white, and had opened the Sicilian quite correctly. He had pondered each move long and hard. Whatever his physical handicap as a result of the stroke, there was nothing wrong now with his intellectual acuity. Salander sat there reading a book on the frequency calibration of radio telescopes in a weightless state. She was sitting on a cushion, the better to be level with the table. When Palmgren made his move, she glanced up and moved her piece, apparently without studying the board, and went back to her book. Palmgren resigned after the 27th move. Salander looked up and with a frown inspected the board for perhaps 15 seconds. "Now," she said, "you have a chance for a stalemate." Palmgren sighed and spent 5 minutes studying the board. At last he narrowed his gaze at Salander.
"Prove it."
She turned the board around and took over his pieces. She forced a stalemate on the 39th move.
"Good Lord," Sivanandan said. "That's the way she is. Don't ever play with her for money," Palmgren said.
Sivanandan had played chess himself since he was a boy, and as a teenager he was in the school tournament in Åbo, and came in second. He regarded himself as a competent amateur. Salander, he could see, was an uncanny chess player. She had obviously never played for a club, and when he mentioned that the game seemed to have been a variant of a classic game by Lasker, she gave him an uncomprehending look. She had never heard of Emanuel Lasker. He could not help wondering whether her talent was innate, and if so, whether she had other talents that might interest a psychologist. But he did not say a word. He could see that his patient was feeling better than he ever had since coming to Ersta. Bjurman arrived home late in the evening. He had spent 4 whole weeks at his summer cabin outside Stallaholmen, but he was dispirited. Nothing had happened to change his situation except that the giant had informed him that his people were interested in the proposal and that it would cost him 100,000 kroner. Mail was piled up on the doormat. He put it all on the kitchen table. He was less and less interested in everything to do with work and the outside world, and he did not look at the letters until later in the evening, then he shuffled through them absent-mindedly. One was from Handelsbanken. It was a statement for the withdrawal of 9,312 kroner from Lisbeth Salander's savings account. She was back. He went into his office and put the document on his desk. He looked at it with hate-filled eyes for more than a minute as he collected his thoughts. He was forced to look up the telephone number. Then he lifted the receiver and dialed the number of a mobile with a prepaid calling card. The blonde giant answered with a slight accent.
"Yes?"
"It's Nils Bjurman."
"What do you want?"
"She's back in Sweden."
There was a brief silence at the other end.
"That's good. Don't call this number again."
"But
you will be notified shortly."
Then, to his considerable irritation, the connection was cut. Bierman swore to himself. He went over to the drinks cabinet and poured himself a triple measure of Kentucky bourbon. He swallowed the drink in two gulps. "I've got to go easy on the booze," he thought. Then he poured one more measure and took the glass back to his desk, where he looked at the statement from Handelsbanken again. Mimi was massaging Salander's back and neck. She had been kneading intently for 20 minutes while Salander mainly enjoyed herself and uttered an occasional groan of pleasure. A massage from Mimi was a fantastic experience, and she felt like a kitten who just wanted to purr and wave its paws around. She stifled a sigh of disappointment when Mimi slapped her on the backside and said that should do it. For a while she lay still in the vain hope that Mimi would go on, but when she heard her pick up her wine glass, Salander rolled onto her back.
"Thank you,"
she said. "You're sitting in front of your computer all day. That's why your back hurts. I just pulled a muscle." They were lying naked in Mimi's bed on Lundergarten, drinking red wine and feeling silly. Since Salander had resumed her friendship with Mimi, it was as if she couldn't get enough of her. It had become a bad habit to call her every day, much too often. She looked at Mimi and reminded herself not to get too close to anyone again. It might end with someone getting hurt. Mimi leaned over the edge of the bed and opened the drawer of her bedside table. She took out a small, flat package wrapped in flowered paper with a gold bow and tossed it into Lisbeth's lap.
"What's this?" "Your birthday present."
"My birthday's more than a month away."
"It's your present from last year, but I couldn't find you."
"Should I open it?"
"If you feel like it."
She put down her wine glass, shook the package, and opened it carefully. She drew out a beautiful cigarette case with a lid of blue and black enamel and some tiny Chinese characters as decoration.
"You really should stop smoking," Mimi said, "but if you won't, at least you can keep your cigarettes in a pretty box."
"Thank you,"
Salander said.
"You're the only person who ever gives me birthday presents." "What do the characters mean?"
"How on earth would I know that? I don't understand Chinese. I just found it at the flea market."
"It's beautiful."
"It's just some cheap nothing, but it looked as if it was made for you."
"We've run out of wine. Do you want to go out and get a beer?" "Does that mean we have to leave the bed and get dressed?"
"I'm afraid so. But what's the point of living in Surda if you can't go to a bar now and then?"
Salander sighed.
"Come on," Mimi said, pointing at the jewel in Salander's navel. "We can come back here afterwards."
Salander sighed again, but she put one foot on the floor and reached for her underwear. Svensson was working late at the desk he had been assigned in a corner of the Millennium offices when he heard the rattle of a key in the door. He looked at the clock and saw that it was past 9 p.m. Blomqvist seemed surprised to find someone still working there.
"The lamp of diligence and all that, Mikhail. I'm fine-tuning the book and I lost track of time. What are you doing here?"
"Just stopped by to pick up a file I forgot."
"Is everything going well?"
"Sure. Well, actually, no. I've spent 3 weeks trying to track down Björk from Seppo. He seems to have vanished without a trace. Perhaps he's been kidnapped by some enemy secret service."
Blomqvist pulled up a chair and sat thinking for a moment.
"Have you tried the old lottery trick?"
"What's that?"
"Think of a name, write a letter saying that he's won a mobile telephone with a GPS navigator or whatever, print it out so it looks official, and post it to his address. In this case, that P.O. box he has. He's already won the mobile, a brand new Nokia, but more than that, he's one of 20 people who can go on to win 100,000 kroner. All he has to do is take part in a marketing study for various products. The session will take about an hour and be done by a professional interviewer. And then, well..."
Svensson stared at Blomqvist, open-mouthed.
"Are you serious?"
"Why not? You've tried everything else. And even a spook from Seppo should be able to figure out that the odds of winning 100 grand are pretty good if he's one of only 20 people on the list."
Svensson laughed out loud.
"You're nuts. Is that legal?"
"I can't imagine it's illegal to give away a mobile telephone."
"You really are out of your mind."
Svensson kept laughing. Blomqvist hesitated a moment. He was actually on his way home and seldom went to bars, but he liked Svensson's company.
"Do you feel like going out for a beer?" he said.
Svensson looked again at the clock.
"Why not?" he said.
"Gladly. A quick one. Let me leave a message for Mia. She's out with the girls, and was going to pick me up on her way home."
They went to Kvarnen, mostly because it was comfortable and close by. Svensson chuckled as he composed the letter to Bjerk at Security Police HQ. Blomqvist looked dubiously at his easily amused colleague. They were lucky enough to get a table near the door. Each of them ordered a large glass of strong beer, and with their heads together they began to drink and discuss Svensson's book. Blomqvist did not see Salander standing at the bar with Miriam Wu. Salander took a step back to put Mimi between her and Blomqvist. She looked at him from behind Mimi's shoulder. She had not been in a bar since she came back, and just her luck, she had to run into him, Kalle fucking Blomqvist. It was the first time she had seen him in more than a year.
"What's wrong?"
Mimi said.
"Nothing."
They kept talking. Or rather, Mimi went on with her story about a dyke she had met on a trip to London a few years back. She had been visiting an art gallery, and the situation had got funnier and funnier as Mimi tried to pick her up. Salander nodded now and then, but as usual missed the point of the story. Blomqvist had not changed much, she decided. He looked absurdly well, approachable and relaxed, but with a grave expression. He was listening to what his companion was saying, nodding now and then. It seemed to be a serious discussion. Salander looked at Blomqvist's friend, a man with a blonde crew cut several years younger than Blomqvist, who was talking intently. She had no idea who he was. All of a sudden, a whole group came up to Blomqvist's table and shook hands with him. Blomqvist got a pat on the cheek from a woman who said something everyone else laughed at. Blomqvist looked self-conscious, but he laughed too. Salander scowled.
"You're not listening to what I'm saying," Mimi said. "Of course I am.
You're terrible company in a bar."
"I'll give up. Should we go home and fuck instead?"
"In a bit," Salander said. She moved a little closer to Mimi and put a hand on her hip. Mimi looked down at her partner and said, "I feel like kissing you on the mouth."
"Don't do it."
"Are you afraid people will think you're a dyke?"
"I don't want to attract attention right now."
"Let's go home then."
"Not yet. Wait a while."
They did not have long to wait. 20 minutes after they arrived, the man Blomqvist was with got a call on his mobile. They drained their glasses and stood up simultaneously.
"Check it out," Mimi said. "That guy over there is Mikael Blomqvist. He was more famous than a rock star after the Venestrom affair."
"You don't say.
Did you miss all that? It was about the time when you left the country."
"I've heard it mentioned."
Salander waited for another 5 minutes before she looked at Mimi.
"You wanted to kiss me on the mouth?"
Mimi looked at her in surprise.
"I was just teasing."
Salander stood on tiptoe and pulled Mimi's face down to her level and gave her a long, deep kiss. When they separated, there was applause.
"You're nuts. You know that?"
Mimi said. Salander did not get home until 7 in the morning. She pulled out the neck of her T-shirt and sniffed. She thought about taking a shower, but decided the hell with it, and instead left her clothes on the floor and went to bed. She slept till 4 in the afternoon, then got up and went down to Surahalana Market and had breakfast. She thought about Blomqvist, and about her reaction to suddenly finding herself in the same room as him. She had been annoyed at his presence, but she also discovered that it no longer hurt to see him. He had been transformed to a little blip on the horizon, a minor perturbation factor in her existence. There were worse disturbances in life. But she wished she had had the guts to go up to him and say hello, or possibly break his legs. She wasn't sure which. Anyway, she was curious about what he was up to. She ran a few errands in the afternoon and came home around 7 p.m. She booted up her powerbook and started Asphyxia 1.3. The icon Mikbloom/laptop was still on the server in Holland. She double-clicked and opened a copy of Blomqvist's hard drive. It was her first visit to his computer since she had left Sweden more than a year ago. She noticed with satisfaction that he still had not upgraded to the latest Mac OS, which would have meant that Asphyxia would have crashed and the hacking would have been terminated. She realized that she would have to rewrite the program so that an upgrade would not interfere with it. The volume on the hard drive had increased by almost 6.9 gigabytes since her previous visit. A large part of the increase was due to PDF files and Quark documents. The documents did not take up much room, but the bitmaps did, despite the fact that the images were compressed. Since he had returned as publisher, he had apparently archived every issue of Millennium. She sorted the files on the hard disk by date, with the oldest at the top, and noticed that Blomqvist had spent a great deal